The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri, from the retreat called Anatta, the Buddha's Teaching on Non-Self, taught by Gloria Terania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Gloria Terania Ambrosia teaches within the Thai forest tradition and is a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She has been a Dhamma teacher since 1990, served as a resident teacher of the Insight Meditation Society from 1996 to 1999, and is a core faculty member at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, where she does most of her teaching. For more information, go to www.bcbsdharma.org.
So what I want to look at tonight is, just a whole nother level of this, we see and slowly, gradually over the years of practice, learn to deconstruct the layers of self-view, to see the layers and begin to unravel what the mind is doing, which essentially is, seeing directly the tangles that we're getting into out of not seeing things clearly. And through that kind of understanding, through that kind of direct knowledge, direct seeing, then beginning to unravel it all. And this is powerful stuff. And I haven't found anything more satisfying than to be able to see and untangle some persnickety, relentless habit of mind that has been a torment for many, many years. So in order to see this teaching or this truth of anatta for ourselves, we have to be able to develop a way to see our karmic patterns, to see the mental fashionings, the mental fabrications, the mental states that tend to arise in this mind, and to see them with a ever-increasing degree of non-attachment. So impartiality, however you want to characterize that, what we're talking about is being able to see it like as if it's somebody else's, you know? It's so that tendency to get pulled into either the state itself or the self-loathing that often follows on the heels of seeing what we're doing, we're just making the effort to gradually, slowly stop doing both of those. And so that the quality of heart changes. It shifts dramatically from attachment, from being caught and resisting, to actually just seeing it with a high degree of impartiality. And it's hard to talk about this without sounding like it's okay to be the way that we are, which it is. And if we're suffering with it, we want to be able to move through it. But we see that the way that we've been trying to get free of these states doesn't work. It hasn't ever worked. So what the Buddha gives us is a technology, really. But it's more than a technology. It's a description of a mind that is getting liberated. I talked about this earlier. You work with the foundations of mindfulness, particularly the third and the fourth. And what they're saying is, see a mind that has that state in it, whatever that state is, and see the mind that is free of that state, and discern for ourselves in very subtle ways. The mind discerns for itself where it wants to be. You know, but it has to get a good clean hit of what it's like to be caught and what it's like to be free in order for that to happen. So what we do is we get acquainted with, over the years of practice, we get very acquainted with our individual patterns. We all know what they are. And we begin to get more skilled at just knowing them, the simple fact of their being there, without being caught up in them, and without being at the mercy of them. I don't know about you, but I just find that huge. that is just huge to be able to alter that significantly, the relationship with something that seems so intimate and personal as my own states of mind. This is who I am, you know, but we're getting outside of that. How could that be true if it's who we are? We're looking at it instead of being caught in it or resisting it or hating it. And so what this does over time, that in itself is enough. There's a huge liberation that takes place just in being able to reorient the mind to see things in that way. Yeah, haven't you felt that? Even just a little bit. Maybe it's a little harder with mental states, but if you relate differently to a pain in your knee or pain or difficult sensations, you know, we've seen it. Well, the same is true of how we can learn to relate to the mind. So that's enough. But what it's doing, and this is the brilliance of the meditation that the Buddha is outlining for us, what it's doing is positioning us for insight. It's only when we can stand back from these things that we are habituated to grabbing and breathing into life. It's only when we can stand back and see them in this way that we can begin to contemplate their nature. And the way the Buddha describes that, and it's for us to see, that their nature is to arise and pass away. They aren't permanent conditions. Their nature is to, if we grab them, especially to be a source of difficulty and suffering for us, and to recognize that we don't have the kind of control over these that we think that we do, and so this is pretty deep stuff. You know, we're actually touching the very characteristics of our existence here as human beings, and learning to accommodate to it, if you will. You know, difficult states of mind, the patterns in the mind that are reacting to those, are doing so out of some sense of trying to get us to a place of peace. It's wild, but that's, you know, so you can't, what are you going to do? You're going to hate it? You know, you're not going to hate that stuff. It's just delusion. It's just craving and delusion. And so we stand back from it enough to not only see what it's like not to be attached, but to use that non-attachment for the deeper insights of insight meditation. So you can see just with that much, there's layers to our practice, you know, and that first layer is simply to know that we're in a state, to know that a state has come up into the mind. That may not sound like much, but as I said, I find it that it's huge. And 'cause in the unawakened state, we aren't aware of our patterns as such. Do you want to give some of those out? John has brought some blankets in if people want them. Do you want to take a minute and get some? I'm beginning to feel like Rudolph up here. No. I gotcha. No, I'm not. That's not a criticism. I've managed it. I figured out how to do it. Send it outside. So, this first layer, as we know, is very important. You know, the unawakened mind just isn't aware of patterns as such. We're so identified that we are them. I am my mind. I am my mind states. And so they come and go from one moment to the next. And watch, look and see. This is what you're seeing as you're sitting here meditating all this weekend and in the years preceding this. You know, we're just blindly caught in various states of mind that come into the mind. One of the images the Buddha used is that of a monkey in the jungle that swings from tree to tree, you know, just grabbing one vine, holds on to that, and only lets go when he grabs another one, you know? And so that's the nature of compulsion and being caught in these mind states. It's like you're in one, and it dominates the field. Until or unless something else comes along that's stronger. Or maybe we got bored with it and put it down and pick something else up. So, I mean, it's an amazing image, but it's kind of conveys or connotes a sense of being on automatic pilot, living life very compulsively and not having any options outside of that. I mean, I've sure felt that way, haven't you? It's neurotic as hell, but that's the way we are in the unawakened state. So as I've noted, and I do harp on this a bit because it's been a critical part of my own practice, one of the things that is the biggest player in breaking through or plowing through this first layer, if you will, of being able to see states, is to learn how to hold that moment when you snap out of it. And just to be able to capture that and in a way sort of freeze frame it. Because one of the beautiful things about that moment, which we may not realize and we may not be taking in, but look and see, don't believe me. Like in that moment where you've realized that you're back, you've been in a state, and now you're not in it anymore. You've let it go. That moment, at least for a few seconds until it gets stronger, is very lucid. It's a very clear, a moment of very clear seeing. And in that moment, if we know how to use it, we can really feel what it feels like not only to have been caught, but what it feels like to be free. It will only last a few seconds, at least initially, but, that's good enough. And some people were alluding to the fact that, you know, we're breaking free even though we're not taking things in very fully. And that's true. So a lot of it's going on whether we do. But if you can shine the spotlight on that and really take it in, it can be incredibly powerful. You know, but what you see over and over again, and this is not to become gloomy about it, but the mind will very quickly deflect the attention away from that moment. And it'll deflect the attention away from that moment by going on about the pain of having been in this other state. And one way or another, it'll do that either by sort of going into self-loathing. You did it again. I can't believe you did that. You've been all caught up and beating up on ourselves. Or it might just turn to a whole nother story, a whole nother state, you know. And so really, I think part of what we need to see is the subtlety of what's happening in that movement of the mind. Because the reality is that being out to lunch and being deluded and caught up is very unpleasant. And so the mind doesn't stay there. It doesn't want to hang with the unpleasantness of delusion. So, you know, it's moving. It's on the move very, very much. And it'll start to try to get away from the pain of this mental torment. And these are the forms that it takes. It either beats up, has something to say about, goes on about it, or picks up a whole nother state, just tries to ignore it and pretend that it didn't happen. You know, and as I was saying earlier, even the scrambling back to the breath when we come to can be a way of deflecting the attention away from the pain that we're in. And yet we want to feel that. We want to know the pain that we're in when we're caught in these states of delusion. So you see those impulses, these primordial instinctive impulses to get away from pain and towards something more pleasant, this is one of the ways that they don't serve us. you know, we actually need to stay put and open and feel what's going on. So this is subtle stuff, you know, but it has to be seen and addressed as practitioners if indeed we want to be able to get to the direct experience. Because the direct experience of the pain of unskillful states, the pleasure of skillful states, is where all the action is. And we've got to be able to get to that and open to it and see what's going on. And I think this is to me, this is really the lion's share of practice. You know, in a more diluted state, we're holding it in a way that says our job as practitioners is to clean up our act. And we're going to all the old ways of doing that to try to fix it and make our act better, if you will. When really, I think what the practice is saying is that our practice is much more about opening to the act that we have, not getting to something else. And so, yeah, that I'm not saying this is easy, but that means you got to see the pattern and see it with enough impartiality that you get a good clean hit of what it's like to be that way. So maybe you're a greedy person. Well, what's that like? What's it like to be piggy, you know? if you're a hateful person, you know, tend to be hateful. What's it like? Does it feel good? Does one want to persist in being that way? So that's the sentiment behind it. That's the practice. Really being able to open our hearts to our own karmic patterns. And if they don't serve us, we'll feel it. If they do serve us, we will. And we'll use that impulse towards pleasure and away from pain in the interest of our own liberation, not in the interest of self-gratification. It's a dramatic shift. So what I wanted to do tonight is just go, you know, offer you some real practice stories from different people that I've talked to about their practice to sort of bring home the process that goes on working with each of the five hindrances. And granted, you know, and it's kind of just being able to narrow it down like this to give one example of each of the hindrances. It may not be something that you can necessarily relate to, but I'll bet if you think about it, you'll be able to put something in there that you can relate to, or just get at the sentiment of it, get at how this particular practitioner has worked with it and been able to see through what the mind is doing and take it to a place of greater release and freedom. So this is all being done in the interest of changing our relationship with these dominant and difficult states of mind. And feeling, you know, feeling the joy of being able to do that. So let's just look at one. This is one about the greedy mind, you know, the mind that keeps wanting things that it doesn't have. You know, have you seen this? We know this mind very well. So this is for that gal that I was talking to a number of years ago, and she really struggles with fantasy. And this is one of the forms that this greedy mind takes. We tend to be caught up in imagining things, imagining a better world. And for her, she said that what she does is she realizes that in one way or another, very frequently in her life, she finds fault with the present. She finds something about the present that's going on that she doesn't like and wants it to be some different way. So she begins to imagine better worlds and then for a while moves into those worlds, you know, just fantasizing and imagining. And so, you know, for you it might not be out and out fantasy, but it could be just something that one thinks if I just only had this, my life would be better. If I only had this, all of it would be better. So, and these better worlds that she would describe, they usually involved just getting away from certain people in her life, getting away from certain conditions. Like if she wasn't with the man she was with, it would be better. If she was with this other man, it would be better, that kind of thing. Or if she didn't have the house that she had, it would be better. She starts to imagine a better house, a different place to live, and always imagining better and different conditions. And mind you, this is what I was hinting at earlier. All of this, if you look at the mind, you can't fault the mind. What it's trying to do is find happiness. It's trying to find peace. And this is the best that it can do, you know. It's fabricating a world that one imagines contains that. That's different than the world that we're in. So, I mean, she was a long-time practitioner, very skilled in practice, and was even a little sort of startled and surprised, as I recall, to see that she was doing this and to admit it to herself. But it was great. So as she practiced with it over the years, and literally this is over a period of years, you know, she began to see how frequently she was lost in this kind of thinking, what an unbelievably common pattern it was for her. And as she put it, she said, maybe for a little while I was happy. As I imagined that world and I moved into that world, you know, but all the while she's fantasizing, you know, that world isn't real. She's just thinking about it and imagining it. But let's be honest. I mean, come on, that's why we all fantasize. It's a very pleasant, your attachment to pleasant thinking, pleasant ideas, pleasant thoughts is pleasant for the time that we're doing it. But, and then she'd have things like, oh, that's it, that would be great, that's what I need. If I just had that, everything would be all right. But then inevitably she'd emerge from that state and from her dream world and realize how painful it was to be lost in it, how painful it was to be lost in that way. And she began to notice in those moments that moment of breaking free and emerging from it, she often had a feeling of nausea, you know, like and a kind of a tightening in the gut. These are very, you know, subtle feelings that we completely miss when because we're skipping over it. But she would begin to notice this, and it would be, she was characterizing it this way. Yes, I want that, and that would feel good. That's how it feels when you're in the thought. But then when she would emerge from it, she was like, but doing this is so unpleasant. Being caught in this fantasy world is so unpleasant. And too, she began to notice, and this was a critical juncture for her, that how that repeated being lost in fantasy was actually impacting and affecting the way that she felt about the life that she did have. It was a cyclical thing. It was actually creating more discontent. You know, because that this other world had such a reality, was so large in her mind. And so, you know, it's a two-way street. You don't like your world, so you create another one. But then, you know, that's not a solution either. And when you get caught in a lot of that kind of thinking, it actually is making the discontent with the world that we have even greater. You know, I bet you've seen this. And this is the kind of unraveling and untangling that we have to do with these states. So when we're lost in fantasy or just wanting things that we don't have, we can't see in those moments that we're actually becoming more entrenched in delusion and more entrenched in unhappiness. And all of this is being set up as a way to get us to happiness. But the state itself is a very unhappy state. And this can escape us for quite some time. You know, this is the brilliance of some of what the Buddha is pointing to. So, and it may not be immediately apparent because the content of fantasies can be so delicious. You know, this has been one of mine too. You know, I just my mind just loves to dream, loves to fantasize. And besides being pleasant, it can all seem so real when you're in it. Can it? I mean, have you ever been caught in fantasy and you snap out of it and you go, that wasn't even real. We're just lost in it. So we can enjoy ourselves in our desires and our fantasies. And for the moment, we actually think that this is better. But then when you snap out of it, you know, you see a different reality. And the truth of the matter is, in some of the lore, is maybe life would be better. Maybe it would. I don't know. But the point is that this kind of being lost is a very deluded state. And so that, at least that is a solution, is not a solution at all. So, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we want to be able to see. And one of the things that was really the icing on the cake for her was she actually got so capable of looking at this tendency in the mind that she could see that she even went back a step and realized that this feeling of not being content in the present with the conditions of her life, that the way that she was relating to that itself was to actually make that the problem. It's like the mind was actually creating that feeling of discontent. And then, in the subsequent moments, hating it and trying to get rid of it. It's amazing. But that's what it's doing. You know, you can actually believe that there's something wrong with your life, and then you get lost in all of this stuff. But when you can actually see that you actually created that feeling too, there's nothing wrong with your life. It's fine the way that it is. Then, that, you know, you really can cut through this whole habit and pattern. Okay, so can you see the delusion here? It's got many layers, and it runs very, very deep. So that's one. Anyway, I just realized when I was thinking about that earlier, no wonder we can be so crazy with this stuff, you know. We're creating the problem and then trying to get rid of it. So let's look at hatred or ill will. And this is often towards the people in our lives. I was talking to someone who noticed that he was expending a fair amount of energy, just being caught up and irritated with a particular person in his life. Now, this might be the situation for you. It might be a person. It might be a condition. One of the things that's going on in your life, I don't know, maybe it's a job or something like that. But we end up spending a lot of energy resisting, hating, not wanting it to be that way. And you know, when it comes to people, we can feel wronged in one way or another. And maybe we have been. You know, that's always a possibility. But the point of waking up, in a way, is to see that from the day that we're born until the day we die, there is always going to be stuff coming at us that feels like a jab. You know, and we are being jabbed constantly. That's the nature of dukkha. You know, that we're taking hits from sun up till sundown. Some of them are very minor, and thank goodness we're comfortable enough to know that we don't have a lot of this stuff necessarily in our lives. And so, you know, taking those jabs, in this case, this fellow was aware that this person, for whatever reason, just keeps rubbing him the wrong way. And the mind is spinning out and trying to figure out what to do about this person who rubs in the wrong way. If you can feel that, that's the repeated and constant state of ill will. So, you know, maybe you are taking a jab, and that, you know, one has to know that. But that doesn't change how we react to it. That doesn't change how we work with our reaction to it. You know, most of us, I dare say, aren't very quick on our feet. And so what happens is when somebody jabs us or irritates us or barks at us or something like this, we may not be, you know, we may not catch it right there. We may not even know that we've just taken a jab. We may be not able to be sensitized. You have to be quite still to realize that something's coming at you like that. And as we get more skilled in this, you can actually address it in a way that isn't barking back. You know, it's something as simple as, did you mean to say that way? You know, it can diffuse the state in us, and it can also bring a little more information into the system so that we know, we have a little more understanding about what's coming at us from the world. But most of us aren't that quick on our feet, so we aren't able to identify that that's happened, let alone address that difficulty right there on the spot. Or sometimes, I don't know about you, but it might be hours later, it might be days later, after stewing over something for a while, before I begin to see, oh, that's what that was. You know, that's what happened back there. And that's what this fellow was doing. He would get caught in it. And this can also be very complicated by the fact that we don't know what it was that the jab was. We don't know the nature of what's coming at us from the world. So in the meantime, what happens is then we tend to obsess, don't we? Just go on and on and on about building our case, creating a vendetta in the mind about that particular incident or person or situation. And the stories can get quite sophisticated and complex, can't they? You know, you can really build a world wherein we're the one that's being wronged, and that person out there is the one who has wronged us. When the mind goes on and on like this, the thing is that it's not actually making contact with the reality of dukkha in our lives. There is dukkha. There will be dukkha from sun up till sundown. And, you know, one of the liberating moments in my own practice came when I really got that, or started to get it. I can't say I've necessarily even there, but for the moment to break through that sense of, it is not a question of whether or not you're going to get jabbed on any given day. It's more a question of how hard it's going to be and where it's going to come from. You know, it's going to happen. And so if we can know that as the way that it is for human beings, there's pain here, there's difficulty in this life, then that right there can offset a lot of the reactive patterning. But, you know, it takes a while to get to that. So when the mind goes on and on about something, it hasn't gotten to that. It hasn't gotten to the reality of, I just took a jab. You know, so it goes into fight mode. It goes into resistance. It goes into ill will and hatred. And much of our obsessive thinking is just this. That's what the mind is doing. You know, we don't like the behaviors that are coming at us. And it doesn't matter that whether they're real, whether they're intentional or not. The mind will go into resisting and fighting and wanting it not to be that way. So, you know, throughout the day, there's going to be a lot of these. And seeing that and knowing that is insight, or actually constitutes insight into dukkha, a lot of the insight into dukkha. But when we feel offended by it, or, you know, feel that something needs to be done about it, then we go into obsessive thinking. Yeah? Have you seen this? It's very, very, I mean, you can start to see it in this way, man. It can diffuse the whole energy of this kind of thinking. And this kind of thinking is very, very painful. You know, I've certainly seen it in my own mind. Just, you know, there was this guy I often like to talk about at the monastery one time who just rubbed me the wrong way. Man, and he didn't even have to say anything to me. I just hearing him come down the hall, you know, and I could go into hating him. And I would often, I only saw him in the kitchen for a few minutes every morning. And I could spend the next 18 hours hating him. You know, this is what the mind does when it can't see what it's doing. So the idea here is to stop hating what's coming at us. And hating the source of it, and get to the feeling of taking those jabs itself. I mean, you start to feel like a punching bag, and this can sound gloomy. I'm not trying to sound gloomy, but literally, it's like, oh, that sound was too harsh. That person was walk by me too quickly. They jumped ahead of me in the queue, you know. That guy cut me off. Whatever, it's this kind of stuff, but it's also some very big stuff. So then, as we can acknowledge that, we're getting taken these jabs, then you can either, let it be. Just let it be. It's another imperfect moment in samsara. one way to define it. Or determine that one needs to address it and do that. But the way that we address difficult people and difficult situations will be infinitely affected by the quality of our capacity to accept that they actually happened before we address it. And so, at the very least, even if the obsessing continues, then we'll know it as such, and we'll know it as the repeated experience of pain. So just look and see, see these things. I mean, there's probably been a few opportunities to address it even here on this retreat. So sloth and torpor. I call this the I don't want a voice, that bit that just it doesn't have a whole lot of energy to it, but it's kind of whiny, and it doesn't. I don't wanna. And there's a lot of places where you see this, but one of my favorite places is first thing in the morning. And I've learned to work with it there very effectively through the years. It's a very rich area of practice. So what happens, is that right away, right out of the gate, you're only conscious, back into consciousness for a few minutes, and it's up and running, so what happens is that you can find yourself caught in a kind of a clash and a confrontation between battling impulses or battling intentions right there in the first thing in the morning. And the one wants us to get up. It wants us to get up with a high degree of energy and interest in embracing life. I've even seen my mind just want me to dash to the meditation cushion. I'm so excited to be awake and have a new day, and I can't wait to get up and get going and go to my meditation cushion. So that's on the one hand, you got that voice. And it is kind of like a Dharma coach in there trying to get us to greet life with a little vigor, And then there's the comfort of the bed and the warmth, and then especially if it's winter, the knowing that you're going to have to get through these first moments where it's unpleasant, it takes a while just even to get to the coffee pot, and to set it up, and that those moments are going to be unpleasant. The floor might be cold, the air is going to be cold, you have to pee, and all of that. So this is the battle that takes hold right away, and the battlefield dialogue can all appear very, very rational. One may look at the clock, for example, and decide rationally. I do this one a lot. Very quickly, it starts to go into, when did I go to sleep last night? Have I been in bed enough? Have I gotten enough sleep such that I need to stay here a little bit longer, right? It'll count the hours and see. It's not looking at whether or not I'm tired. It's rationally determining whether or not I've had enough sleep. Or you may notice that we're actually wide awake. And maybe we don't want to admit that, but we're actually wide awake. And the inner Dhamma coach is trying to give us all the good reasons why we should get up. And if you've seen this, one of the things that I thought for years watching this, really literally years, is that one of those voices was right. and what was going to happen. I would just sort of lay there and try to see which one was going to win, which one was going to be the impulse that was going to drive the next moment or the first few moments of my day. But really, you know, if we're practicing and working with this kind of thing skillfully, and hopefully we are, then you're going to learn a lot about attachment and the consequences to it, those attachments very early on, right away, first thing in the morning. Because when we settle down, and when, if you can just drop out of all of that, just settle down and get to the direct experience of what we're feeling right then you find out that you get up or you don't. You know, but that impulse is happening not because of this false dilemma that's being created in the mind, but because you dropped it. It's like you have to get under that whole false dilemma that's being constructed in the mind. Which, should I do this or should I do this? Should I do this or should I? How many times have you felt that? And the delusion is that one of those is right and I've got to find the right one and follow it. When really the delusion is that we're buying into any of it. You just let go. And haven't you had the experience of, once you can do that, then you get up. You don't, or you don't. Maybe you lay there. But, there's more of a sense of release and relief. You get to see from this kind of experience that the body is really operating according to its own laws. It knows, but you just have to drop out of the tangles and get into the direct experience, and movement happens, action happens, but it's not because we came up with the right thing. It's because we let go of the false dilemma that's going on here. So look and see. I mean, there's a lots of potential in looking at sloth for understanding these dynamics of the mind. So restlessness and worry. I'm going to go on, even though it goes a little over. I know this fella who worries a lot. He's just he lives in a state of high anxiety and really is trying to uncover the fact that he's actually creating all of this, you know, out of the way that he's relating to things. And he worries a lot about the future. Repeatedly he anticipates a gloomy future. And then starts to fight it and resist it and try to set things up so that gloomy future doesn't happen. He'll do this and do that and everything that he can to offset the possibility of that gloomy future. And he runs himself ragged doing this. You know, I know it, man. I certainly do it. You know, we're driven by fear and anxiety largely because we haven't touched the Nichidukkha Anatta. But that's another story. So this kind of thing is really a good one to contemplate. We imagine a gloomy future or things outside of our control, not being able to manage and be on top of everything that's going on in our lives. And then we relate to that with worry and anxiety. So once again, if you can feel that, we just constructed a world that produces anxiety. And then we get born into the anxiety as a solution to that world. Really? Can you see it? It's quite amazing to untangle. This is really good to contemplate. So the thing is, and this is the basis of all of the hindrances, but certainly restlessness and worry, we don't have a lot of control in our lives. No matter what we do, no matter how much we try to set it up so that we don't suffer, there will be suffering in our lives. There will be difficulty in our lives. And we don't know what's going to happen. We never have. We never will. You can set it all up and manage things in a way so as to offset these things. You can try to do that. But the reality is that things are uncertain. There will always be difficulty. And not much of what goes on here is subject to our control. We're not the CEO of all of this. We're not the director. We're not in the driver's seat like we like to think that we are. And that can sound very pessimistic and gloomy, but what the Buddha is pointing to is that this is the reality that we got born into. And to the extent that we know that and get that, the anxiety, the restlessness and the agitation and the worry in our lives will be dramatically diminished. You know, just kind of look and see if that's true. I mean, if you get it that there is dukkha, there is and will be difficulty, then when that happens, it's actually received or greeted in the mind as normal. It's because we think it's abnormal that we fight and resist, like something's wrong. I shouldn't be suffering. There shouldn't be this difficulty. So I've got to fight it. And it's really uncanny how these insights will shift the whole inner terrain of the mind. These insights into anicca, dukkha, and anatta are sort of... They just make the hindrances go poof, you know, because the hindrances are there as a safeguard against anicca, dukkha, and anatta. They're trying to protect us against these. These are reactive patterns that are endeavoring to make things always be pleasant, to make things always be certain and secure and subject to our control. And yet that's not the way that it is. It never has been. So these can sound like stark realities, but the insight into them is very, very liberating, particularly with this state, restlessness and worry and the anxiety in our lives. And admittedly, it's tricky, you know, because, you know, one could say that, well, if I do this and this and this and this and this, then it'll be more likely that things will come out okay. Yeah? And that's true. You know, but you play in the odds, and because it may not go that way. You don't know, because those realities are still there, even though we're doing everything that we can in our mad scramble to try to offset them. You know, and sometimes you get away with it, and that's what sort of imprints this idea that they're somehow subject to our control. Or you could say, well, if I store up my treasures, if I store up and things for a rainy day, that kind of thing, then I'll be better off. And that's true. That's probably true on one level. You know, conventionally speaking, that's true. But there is still anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And so you don't know for sure. You can't control for these conditions. You know, it's relentless, really. And we have to be as relentless in knowing and understanding the truth of anicca, dukkha, anatta as the tendency, the deluded tendency to offset them is. That's some powerful stuff for practice. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do things to secure the future. You know, we were talking about this in one of the groups today. The Buddha was quite clear on this. There's a lot in the suttas, especially when he's talking to lay people, that sounds a lot like, you know, make sure that you have a good insurance policy for your house or for your health or things like that. Make sure that you do things that secure the future for your family, you know. He says this a lot in the teachings. But that's really addressing the conventional reality that we find ourselves in. And to me, like, a lot of waking up and a lot of practice is learning how to juggle, to identify what falls within the realm of conventional reality and what's in the more absolute. and learning to juggle these two, so that you work to secure the conventional reality, but always in the back of the mind, you know the truth. You know what's going on. Then if things fall apart, if things don't go, you know, the insurance company closes and then your house burns down, you know, then this is not a huge issue. It's not something that one has to go into a huge state about. We just deal with this. So one last one, just looking at doubt, the hindrance of doubt in the mind. And in a way, it's kind of the effect of self-denigrating thought and the consequences of that. And this goes to a fellow that I talked to. He's a teacher. And he worries because he feels that he doesn't know enough. He is like, should I be teaching? I don't know if I know enough. I really want to be able to offer Dhamma. There's this beautiful arising from the heart to be able to offer it, and but yet the concern that if I tell people things that aren't exactly right, then I'll be misguiding them. I won't be helping them at all. And so my first thought and my first response to him was that, you know, if you didn't have those kinds of thoughts, then I'd worry. You know, that really, if you have that, if you're worried about misguiding people, then one takes great care not to say things that you're not sure about, and to find out things that we aren't confident about in our own understanding. So that kind of takes care of itself. But there was definitely more to it for him, and he went on to ask, you know, how can I advise other people when I can't stop the behaviors myself? Yeah. And this is a good one. I think we've probably all felt that feeling. And again, I just laughed and said that, you know, knowing what to do, knowing how to practice with patterns, being able to uproot those patterns are two different things. You know, and you have to know that as a practitioner. And haven't you had the experience, all of us, of garnering some one insight or another, and then in the very next moment acting as if you never understood that at all, never got it at all? And this is what the Buddha's pointing to in this sutta. I think I was alluding to it earlier in the day, that experience of what he calls unworldly, unpleasant feeling. And then don't be tripped up by that word unworldly. It's just something that's not, doesn't have to do with sensory gratification. It's a feeling. You know, it's a feeling of unpleasantness around a mood or a mind state. Yeah. So, you know, we want to be able to feel that. We want to be able to know that feeling of insight. And the suffering that we feel on not being able to always act upon it. Because that's actually the stuff that arouses what he called samvega, or a sense of spiritual urgency, where held in the right way, what you do is, instead of beating up on yourself because it's not clear or you don't know, instead you go, oh, I better find out. So it actually arouses a high degree of interest and investigation and spiritual urgency when we allow that some things, the practice, even with insight, it takes time to stabilize into the knowing of things in a consistent way. You know, a lot of people complain that, well, I got it, and then I lost it, and I got it, and I lost it. And, you know, my only response to that is, yeah. That's the way it goes. That's the way practice goes. You get it, and you lose it. But that's just all part of the process. And over the years of practice, that getting it and losing it, and the time between those is just collapsing and collapsing and collapsing. Where, you know, it's getting more and more stable and permanent and able to see things in a consistent way. So, you know, we've got to learn to see this kind of thinking in a way, put it under the microscope. This is doubt. This is the experience of doubt in the mind, and dissect what's going on here. You know, what happens in moments like this is that, you know, we touch a place of not knowing, not being certain, not being clear, not understanding in one way or another. And the mind doesn't like that feeling. And so it tries to get away from that feeling of not knowing and not being clear and not understanding. And what it's doing actually is actually creating the person that it's trying not to be. It's getting caught up in this feeling of doubt and confusion and delusion. And so, you know, the very person that we're trying so hard not to be is what we become. We become a person who is very confused and filled with doubt. So the mind is actually creating the identity and getting born into it. It's amazing. But that's what it's doing. And we'll see this over and over again. And a lot of it is just being predicated around not, like in this case with doubt, is when we don't know and the mind is trying to force knowing. We don't know. We don't understand. We're not really anchored or stable or rooted in the clear seeing yet. And the mind is, it's mad that that's not the case. What good is that? You know, how is that going to help? So just to see really over the months and years of practice, to see this, to be as relentless in our efforts to see what the mind is doing and to see what is happening as the mind is relentless in turning to unskillful and difficult states. And really working our practice in a way that is constantly working with that edge. And just to reiterate, these five hindrances are very deluded responses to things that in many instances the mind just created as problems and now is actually trying to deal with them in one way or another. Wanting, I've got a life that feels like it's not the life that I want. I just created that, and now I'm scrambling to try to make that a reality. Or look at the mind that it takes a jab, that doesn't really get it, that this is the way that life is, and scrambles and responds to that with violence, ill will, hatred, trying to make that not to be the way that it is. But it just happened. It is the way that it is. And looking at sloth and torpor, how we bury our heads in the sand and try not to feel, when really what we need to do is desperately is to not run away from what's happening, not stick our heads in the sand, but to turn towards what we're experiencing in any given moment, and so forth, with restlessness and doubt. And so just to be able to get a sense that these hindrances are, I like to call them the unawakened mind's best guess at what to do about the fact of being a human being born into a condition that is constantly uncertain, not subject to our control, and often very difficult. This is what it's what the hindrances are born for, what they live for. And we'll look and see. If there aren't problems in the mind that we can address, it will make some up. It will create them so that it has something to do. It will. So, you know, just to recognize that all of this that's going on in the mind, and don't turn away from these conditions of impermanence, uncertainty, difficulty, lack of control, but rather try to turn our hearts and our awareness towards that and embrace the realities that we've been born into. And as I was telling one of the groups today, I mean, it's uncanny. And it doesn't makes it kind of defies rational understanding. But to the extent that we get these realities, then we'll be a lot happier. You know, because it sounds like you paint a world that is uncertain, not subject to our control, filled with difficulty, often having a lot of difficulty in it. You describe that and say, you know, who wants that? But it is the way that it is. And to the extent that we know that, acknowledge it and embrace it, then you actually find you're a lot happier. It's weird, isn't it? You're just allowing conditions to be the way that they are, not going into battle, not fighting or resisting. So I hope some of this is helpful. I offer this for your reflection tonight. And see if you can see these states and practice with them as we practice during this retreat.